This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. This is episode 147 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max.
Hi, David. Hey, 1 month to go until Father's Day.
Yeah, well, but that means for us, not only fathers, it means we get to go to the Smithsonian Udvar-Hazy Center for their Innovations in Family Flight Day and Outdoor Aviation Display for 2016, which is actually Saturday, the 18th, the day before Father's Day.
Yes, it is. And of course, it's at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, as you say, at the Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center in Chantilly, Virginia, which is actually right adjacent to Washington Dulles International Airport. And we've been doing this now for 5 years, something like that.
Yeah, 5 years, 6 years, at least 5 years.
And this is a great day to bring your entire family out to see the museum and all of its exhibits. Plus, they have a number of folks who have special exhibits for the day, including David and I and the rest of the Airplane Geeks crew. And they also have planes fly in and on display outside.
Yes, assuming the weather's good, considering the weather on the East Coast this spring has not been conducive to anything, but they do fly in aircraft for the day. You could see everything from small Pipers to quadcopters to kites to they've even had a 777, and we've had a C-17 there on various days. So every year it's a little different, but you get to spend time outside as well as see the museum. And of course, Max and I will be broadcasting there. But wait, there's more.
That's right. We traditionally have a dinner after the event at a local restaurant. And we're doing that again this year, kind of a social gathering at 5 p.m. at the Red Robin right down the street from the museum. And if you're available and in the area, we'd love to see you there after the event.
It's very low key. We have a good time, and we just want to spend some time with people with you, our listeners, face to face. The Red Robin dinner seems to be even more fun than we have during the day because we get to just sit down, relax, and chat and talk about airplanes and drones. So we'd like you to come. And if you are going to come and you're considering it, just drop us a quick email at feedback@theuavdigest. So we know we have a head count. We've been really blessed that the Red Robin every year seems to not blink an eye when we show up with 20 people. They seem to and be very responsive, and we have a really good time. So we want to invite our UAV Digest people there too. You're going to have to mingle with the Airplane Geeks people. We're sorry about all that.
There's a lot of overlap.
There's a lot of overlap, but you know, but they're going to be pilots, and so maybe we can bring some more peaceful and harmony together to both of our worlds. So
the manned and the unmanned.
But we'll talk a little bit more about this in the upcoming weeks. But we got a busy show ahead of us, Max, so I guess we should get started. We've got the FAA and the FBI at JFK. We've got fun with zip codes. UAVs become tankers, otherwise known as my worst nightmare. Perching quads. And I get going to do a book review. And as well, we have a fantastic, in my opinion, video of the week. So I guess with that, let's get started. Well, our first story today comes from The FAA. How surprising. This is our week with FAA, as usual.
Can't avoid it.
The FAA, we can't avoid it. The FAA tests FBI drone detection system at JFK.
The FBI has this detection system, and as we all know, there's a lot of concern about UAVs being flown in and around airports. And so a number of systems have been developed and tested in some cases. What we have here are five different rotorcraft and fixed-wing UAS. They participated in about 40 separate tests. This was kind of a collaborative arrangement or collaborative test, interestingly enough. Besides the FAA and the FBI, also participating in this were the Department of Homeland Security, the DHS, also the Department of Justice, the Queens District Attorney's Office, and also the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. So there were a lot of participants, a lot of stakeholders involved in this test.
There's an alphabet soup involved with this test. Now, we had talked originally about the test performed at Atlantic City International Airport, where the FAA test center is. And this was also supported by Griffiths International Airport test site in Rome, where we were up in the fall. And they actually did the flight commanding of the UAVs for the test. So there aren't really any results. I guess the FBI doesn't really want the bad guys to know if it worked or not. So
I'd like to know. I think we should know. But yes, in the FAA press release, there does not appear to be any information about the success or not of the test or what they learned or what might happen next.
So I guess what we know that they're out there looking for ways to detect and avoid. And so it's interesting. And for our people overseas, the Queens District Attorney's Office involves the borough of Queens, which is where John F. Kennedy Airport is. It has nothing to do with Her Majesty, just so that's cleared up. But let's have some fun with zip codes. The FAA let us play with zip codes, didn't they, Max?
They did. In apparent response to a number of Freedom of Information Act requests, the FAA released a spreadsheet that shows the number of UAS registrations by country, by state or province or region, by city, and by postal code or zip code. Now, this is divided into two categories, hobbyist registrations and non-hobbyist registrations. And there are almost 40,000 entries for hobbyist registrations. Now, that's not individuals, that's locations. And nearly 5,000, almost 5,000 non-hobbyist registrations. Now, this does not include the names and addresses of the people who have registered their drones with the FAA. They are not part of what was released. They will be made available, according to the FAA, but only by registration number. So I guess if you know a registration number, you could find out who the individual is with that number.
No, we're not giving out our registration numbers.
No. The data here is really kind of interesting. There are some clusters of registrations across the United States, and quite a number of them actually from outside the U.S. But there are some interesting numbers here.
Yeah, McKinney, Texas had 241 registered. Some of the other ones, the Villages in Florida had 187. Texas seems to have a lot of UAVs flying registered, at least for hobbyists. For non-hobbyists, Menlo Park, it has 176, and Maxwell Air Force Base has 138. Evidently, the Air Force is registering theirs. I didn't look up Langley's to see how I should have looked up Langley's zip code, but I also had some fun looking up various zip codes, like evidently the White House has two drones registered under the hobbyist aspect of it. Trump Tower has one. Did you look at your own zip code?
Oh, of course.
I was sort of surprised to discover that there were two other not hobbyist people or drones registered in my zip code and a professional or not hobbyist. How about you?
Really? Well, I found in my little town 60 registrations.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know who all those people are, but I guess there's a lot of them. Maybe we should start a club or something.
Yeah, well, you can at least fly yours in the neighborhood. I'm still I can't fly with mine because of the airport.
You can also look at this data by state, and California comes out on top for hobbyists. Next for hobbyists is Texas, followed by Florida and New York, and then they drop off pretty dramatically.
But Pennsylvania made the top five.
Yes, you did. It was 17,145. By reference, California has 57,953. When you look at the non-hobbyist numbers, California has twice as many or nearly twice as many as any other state. Of course, it's a large state, but California has 1,212 non-hobbyist registrations. Next up is Florida with 629, followed by Texas. And then they drop off a lot, New York, Georgia, Pennsylvania again.
Yeah, we didn't make the top five, but we're in the top 10. So Pennsylvania. I noticed Connecticut didn't make any list, so, you know.
Yeah, well, it's a small state. So.
I guess the other thing that's been mentioned by a lot of people is the data is a bit irregular or needs some cleansing, as Drone Mama said. Texas is in there as Texas and there's a lot of stuff where it's sort of scrubbing. And my answer to that was, I think one of the Freedom of Information Acts wanted just the raw data. I don't know that the FAA really wanted to put it out like this, but I don't see why they would do that unless somebody asked for it specifically.
Yeah. I think what we're looking at here, and by the way, we'll have a link in the show notes at theuavdigest.com/147, a link to the spreadsheet. So you can actually download this yourself and manipulate the data as you like. But yeah, it looks like the raw data that people entered when they registered. You mentioned Drone Mama taking a look at this. And for example, she found Guam. Now, there are some foreign, outside the United States, I guess that's a territory, but there are some other countries as well. But for Guam, there were at least four different designations for Guam. So it shows up at least four times. So there's some of that kind of data issues that make it a little bit imperfect.
I like the White House. When I looked at the White House one, everything in the data was on all caps. So it was like they had a caps lock. Washington, D.C. was in all caps. I thought that was kind of funny. It was like, okay, but the best thing to say is, okay, so it's out there now in the public. I don't know why we needed a Freedom of Information Act. I don't know what people are getting at, if there was some conspiracy. But I did see something on Twitter, and we did reach out to AirMap. They did a pair of heat maps of the United States, and we'll have these also in the show notes. We'd like to thank them for actually providing them so we could include them. They're kind of neat seeing where the hotspots are in the United States based on this data. It's the continental U.S., so it's not Canada or some of the foreign countries, but you can see various hotspots, and it's kind of amazing that it's pretty much the Eastern Corridor, like it normally is, and California with various splotches along the way. But definitely the megalopolis that is known from D.C. to Boston is where the color is for the hobbyists. So clearly on the East Coast, we're moving ahead as far as registration goes. So, but definitely go to the website, check that out, and I'd like to thank AirMap for actually allowing us to use that.
All right. What do we have coming up next, David?
Oh, we have a tanker story. I was trying to avoid that, but I couldn't resist putting this in here because a group in China completed air-to-air refueling for UASs. It's a tanker and a receiver.
This is kind of drone-on-drone refueling, isn't it?
it's drone on drone refueling. And did you have to go through the Dr. Strangelove metaphor?
I just had to. So this is autonomous aerial refueling. There's a tanker, quote unquote, drone and the receiver. The tanker drone, David, as I understand it, uses cameras to determine the position of the receiver. There's red markers on the receiving drone, and the tanker uses something called feature extraction to generate the coordinates of the markers. So it's able to detect where the drone to be refueled is.
Yeah, and this is... We've seen drone refueling via the Navy doing the probe and drogue. This is actually a boom like the Air Force would refuel. So the tanker drone is in a target space. The aircraft that needs to be refueled comes up underneath it, and then the tanker boom flies there its boom into the other UAV to pass fuel. At that point, they drop the Energizer Buddy down to change the batteries, which is really what I've tried to figure out. Most UAVs are not using fuel. So it's kind of an interesting that, yes, they're capable of doing it, but we're talking quadcopters that tend to use batteries. So interesting technology that it can be done. Is it practical yet? I don't know, but I couldn't not bring up a tanker story about UAVs because it's just, you know.
Maybe it's a technology demonstration in a way for something that may have application to much larger drones, those that are not powered by LiPo batteries, let's say. Perhaps they're just using the smaller UAS as a way to test out the technology, the recognition technology and their boom technology or whatever, sort of on a miniature scale. Maybe the intent is, and as I say, to scale that up to something much, much larger in the future.
We'll see. I'm sure that if there's another tanker story in the future, it will find me. Let's talk about drones perching on walls and ceilings. This is kind of an interesting technology. This was from spectrumieee.org. Automation, robotics, is it spines or spleens?
I think it's microspines.
Microspines. Make it easy for drones to perch on walls and ceilings. We talked about this with Dr. Allen about at Langley about delivering packages out to us for a science project and then going back to recovering it. The package later, which is what Langley's currently working on. This is a theme in variation where it's not the package that stays out there, but the drone. So the drone goes out there and lands and perches itself on a branch or a wall or whatever and stays there and does its experiments and then flies back. And the way it does this perching is by these microspines.
It's kind of an opposed grip strategy. And according to the Spectrum piece in the IEEE article, it says this works by dragging two sets of microspines, which are made out of hardened steel, little spikes on a special suspension, dragging them along a surface in opposite directions, and that kind of creates grip. So these little tiny spines catch against any little tiny bumps and pits on the surface and hang on using this kind of friction. So they've done some really interesting experiments, some demonstrations. They've discovered different techniques that work better than others when it comes to sticking a drone onto a wall or even inverted, I guess, a ceiling or something of that sort. I think they've found that using this kind of gripping technology, the best strategy is to kind of approach the surface straight on and at not too low a speed. So there's some inertia there that I guess helps activate these micro spines. So very fascinating stuff. You know, that's another example, David, of kind of the interesting things, the interesting technologies, the developments that come out of this. It's like the space program, you know, all the stuff that gets invented as a result of supporting, you know, a big program like that, or in this case, this new industry with all this potential. At least all these interesting things.
and supporting a drone from the ceiling. There's support. But it was interesting, the comment was that these microspines have been placed on the top of a quadcopter. So it's easier for it to hang from the ceiling than it is for it to sit on a wall.
Because it's sort of vertical when it's on the wall, right?
Wall, right. And so, but what was interesting was it's easier to hang from the ceiling than on, but once you get it on the ceiling, it's harder to get it off because the thrust of the rotors want to keep it stuck to the ceiling. Whereas you sort of release the power and it falls off the wall and you can fly away easier. So it's interesting that getting it there and getting it stuck there is one challenge, but getting it off is another. So it was a very interesting article, and definitely for people, reach out and look at it, because it's going to be a technology. You know, it's the infamous fly on the wall that you really want. You know, you want a little spy drone to come in and listen to Rob Mark's conversations about anti-drones. So,
all right. Well, on to the video of the week. I love this video, David.
This video I saw on Facebook, and I immediately reached out to the photographer and I said, could we use it for the show? And he said yes. Now, I love Scotland. I love the Forth Bridge. It's beautiful. It's one of the most prettiest bridges on the world. And then you send across the probably one of the prettiest locomotives of all time, which is the Flying Scotsman. And then you film it with a DJI Inspire 1 X5R drone. And what you get is just pure beauty. It's a bright red bridge with a green locomotive and the smoke billowing, chugging behind it. Yeah, I like trains. Just don't let it out. I actually saw the Flying Scotsman when I was over in Europe. I did a lot of train museums as well as airplane museums. And the Flying Scotsman is just gorgeous.
It's a beautiful, beautiful video. Very nicely done. I did have a question, though, David. Maybe you can help me with it. The caption in the video says, the Flying Scotsman crosses the Forth Bridge after a 10-year restoration project. What was restored, the bridge or the train? They both look beautiful.
I'm pretty sure it was the Scotsman.
Okay.
And I put links to the show notes about the liner class A3, the Wikipedia page, because you got to go look at this. It's an amazing locomotive, and with all those beautiful red cars behind it. I was privileged to go across that bridge when I went to from London to Scotland when I was over there. So with that, we've got a bit of a shout out. Embry-Riddle, which is a friend of the show. We like Embry-Riddle. We respect them. They're a good program. Has going to have an online global unmanned aircraft systems risk management class beginning September 8th. Now, what makes this class, and it's a little expensive, it's $495 for 8 weeks, but it's a university class, a certificate class, but it's going to be taught by Dr. Sarah Nilsson, who was our guest on episode 111. So she's teaching the course on regulations and risk management, and I recommend anybody who listens to this show who is in the business maybe want to think about taking this class. Risk management classes are good, especially when you can tell your insurance agent that you do that, because they usually can find a way to provide a discount if they know that you're taking extra precautions, like taking classes on risk management. Hint, hint, hint. I'm not recommending that, but I'm going to give that as a hint, being an insurance agent. but Dr. Nilsson, or Sarah, has actually really been working really hard on this program, and I wish her luck with it. I kind of wish I could take it. We'll see. But definitely, we'll have links to the show notes, but definitely think about it. If you're going to be in the industry and you want to learn more about it, this is a good place to start, especially the legal aspects of it.
And this is an 8-week online course. And it also, I understand, is not looking at this strictly from a U.S. standpoint. As I understand it, this also relates risk management to UAS, and also covers international efforts to address that risk. So it's not just U.S.-centric.
All right. Now, we don't normally do this, but we were provided a sample copy of a book called The Complete Guide to Drones for review. And I took it upon myself to review it. It arrived a week ago, Saturday, and I spent the rest of Saturday reading it. I like this book. If you listen to the show, you know, you've heard the quote, "I'm the historian, he's the engineer. I'm the one looking for the whipped cream that is the Raspberry Pi of his." You know that while I'm technical, I can wire a mean train layout. I'm hardly a techie. Batteries, motors, speed controllers are new to me. It's written by Adam Juniper. It provides a good summary on each with full color photographs. I didn't know a lot of about the technical things like speed controllers and I have flown remote control airplanes, so I understand channels. But I'll be honest with you, I didn't really have a grasp of how a multi-rotor flew, how a quadcopter actually flies and how the rotors change things. And then you start talking about things like Y6s or X8s. And then I'm like, yeah, right. Okay, you've got propellers on tops and bottoms. And this is a really good book. It starts from the very basics. I have to admit that when you open up the introduction and there's a picture of Norma Jean working on her drones in World War II, I figured, okay, this is going to be my kind of book. It has a very light tone to it, for all intents and purposes. There's a little political commentary about the use of military drones that I was sort of a bit taken aback about, but that would be my only real complaint about the book. My favorite quote from the book is a picture of a remote control, and it's labeled spare channels. On a standard drone, most of the switches and dials don't do anything except make the pilot look like they're in charge of a spaceship. So I thought that was a really good comment. He starts off talking about the history of drones, the history of quadcopters and multi-rotors, and a lot of good aviation stories about multi-rotors. And then talks about prosumer goods, pro goods. One of the other things I thought was fantastic was page 59, which he gives pre-flight checklists on what to check about when you're at home and what to check about on site. So the at-home checklist, weather, prepare your batteries, prepare your memory cards, place all the equipment of your craft and ensure that the center of gravity is where it should be, that no single prop and motor bears too much load. So check your center of gravity. Mapping, check the area you're planning to fly for any restrictions or airports. You'll be using flight planning software such as APM, preload the map tiles for the location you're flying it. And structural, make sure that all the aircraft is flight. Then you get out to the field, unpack slowly, give everything a good look over as you get it out to make sure it survived the journey to your location. Really wise, right? Tighten your props, check your lenses, ground control, power up your radio control, check your video, power up your craft, and then make a final check for any dangers before arming and taking off. Pets and children, are they around in the area? He provides case studies. And the other really, really interesting thing is he takes you step by step on how to build your own quadcopter out of wood and using a Raspberry Pi. And Max, you might want to get involved with this. This is right up your alley. But I learned a lot. I consider myself a basic novice when it comes to the actual technology behind UAVs. This was a fantastic book. I recommend it. I'm going to get Max a copy and I'm going to let him give us, and we're also getting a third copy, and I haven't quite figured out how we're going to do it yet, but we're going to give away a copy. But in the meantime, we'll have a link to the book, which is currently on sale at Amazon. It's $19.95 and it is vivid full color. It's a fantastic book. I am so glad that we got it offered. I'm not usually this ecstatic over books, but it was really, really good. I really enjoyed it. I do like the tone of the books. There's a whole series of books called For Dummies books, which I've been very fond of over the years because I like the kind of humor that's involved. And they don't talk down to you. They talk to you. This is another book that doesn't talk down to you. It talks to you, and understand that if you've already delved into building your own, it might be a little not as advanced, but there's a lot of technology in there. You may have built your own quadcopter, but how good are you at framing photographs? I mean, there's a whole section on reading photography, on how to do the photography. You know, you may be a great drone pilot, but you may be a lousy photographer using it. You know, I'm a good photographer but and a lousy drone pilot. But so there's something in this book for everybody. And I hope that if you go out and do look at it or purchase it, send us some feedback and let us know what you think. See if I'm on the mark or I'm completely off my rocker. So with that, I guess that'll do it for the show, Max. What do you think?
I think so. Just we want to thank you all for listening. This has been episode 147 of the UAV Digest. Find us, of course, at theuavdigest.com. We have show notes for this episode, and I think you really want to check out those heat maps. If nothing else, very fascinating. That's at theuavdigest.com/147. We should also mention that if you'd like to visit the event page for the Smithsonian's Innovations in Flight Day in June, where we hope to see many of you, that website is innovationsinflight.si.edu.
Or you can check it out on Twitter. I'm sure they'll start showing up. The hashtag will be InFlight16. You can always find us on Twitter at UAV Digest. You can join our Slack team, which is becoming more and more active every week. And that would be uavdigest.com/team. It'll tell you a little about it, and we'd love you to join the conversation. Likewise on Facebook, facebook.com/theuavdigest. And if you'd like to send us some feedback, or if you're going to be in the area for the event, send it to feedback@theuavdigest.com. Leave a review at Stitcher or iTunes. Last but not least, if you'd like some swag, you can always go to cafepress.com/theuavdigest, or you can also become a patron of the show at patreon.com/theuavdigest. So with all that being done, I'll say this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you for listening.